Once I get on a flight from Tokyo to our home campus in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you know, I used to try and work until my laptop or my laptop battery had completely drained. Now that there's power outlets on planes, that kind of left me in a quandary. So I'll tend to see if I can't get in 6 or 7 hours of work, hopefully get 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And then if I can do that, get on local time, I'm golden and I'm good to go.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, a production of Edu Alliance, a podcast series dedicated to education professionals worldwide. Each episode is a conversation with thought leaders that will enlighten and provide some new thoughts on critical issues facing higher education. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, and thank you for tuning in. I am Dr. Senthil Nathan in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, and with me is my co-host, Dean Hoke in Bloomington, Indiana. Dean, how are you today, and will you introduce our guest?
Well, I'm a bit early today, and in terms of distance, this may be the most distant program we have done so far. I don't know if our listeners know this, but so far we've interviewed people now in 5 different countries. And this time, I think you win the contest for longest away from Bloomington, Indiana. We have with us today Dr. Matthew Wilson, and Dr. Wilson oversees the Japan campus of Temple University, and it's 3,500 undergraduate, graduate, and non-degree students in Tokyo and in Osaka. And in addition to serving in various other senior academic posts, he has taught law in the United States, Japan, South Korea, China, and Vietnam. Good heavens, a lot of different countries. He's also spoken about international opportunities in education at several hundred universities around the world. Well, to everyone, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Dr. Wilson, how are you?
Greetings from Tokyo. Things are going really well here, except for the typhoon that we have rolling in, but hopefully it will be fine.
Very good. Well, Senthil, you, now that we talked about typhoons, you lead off.
Matt, as we just heard in the intro, you worked across many different cultures and regions in the world. So our first question is, what do you see as the values of higher education that actually transcend borders? And at the same time, what are some areas that you see that one needs to adapt and customize in different environments?
You know, when you think about the commonalities, things that transcend borders, there are several things that immediately come to mind. One is, I think education, regardless of the country, one of the primary missions and goals is to provide access to education, to knowledge, to opportunities, and to skills development. I think regardless of the country, there's always a focus on getting that higher education and then plugging that into some type of a career. And we know across educational borders that with an education, greater income is a likely result, better overall health, lower crime, civic involvement, and particularly in today's global world, when we talk about transcending borders, global competitiveness is at the heart of education. Now, taking the second part of that question, talking about, okay, what needs to be adapted? What might need to be customized based on the country? You know, I think one of the underlying features here is when we talk about globalization increases the demand for university education. So when educators come together, talk about what they can do together, or, you know, maybe even looking in that context, what might be relevant, there are several challenges that you need to adapt for. One is language. What language is education offered in? If we're truly talking about a global education, bringing in educators from around the world to specific institution to educate in that native language is something that really is priceless when you think about it. Also, we talk about access and equity. Every country is different in terms of the cost of higher education, how much that is subsidized by the government. You have an outsider coming in to a country, you know, what benefits, what advantages, what subsidies, what support is provided there as well. I think there's also challenges when it comes to logistics. different school years, different approaches, you know, those type of things that are there. And then also quality, technology, and then the depth of the research.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up, Matt. As you're talking, I thought of jet lag as an analogy, because you have worked back and forth between US and primarily Asia. How fast do you adapt as you go back and forth between US and the Far East?
You know, I've got a strategy on airplanes. And really what that is to, once I get on a flight from Tokyo to our home campus in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you know, I used to try and work until my laptop or my laptop battery had completely drained. Now that there's power outlets on planes, that kind of left me in a quandary. So I'll tend to see if I can't get in 6 or 7 hours of work, hopefully get 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And then if I can do that, get on local time, I'm golden and I'm good to go.
Okay. Dean?
Matt, many US institutions have established branch campuses throughout the world, not only Japan, but of course, even in our country, particularly in the UAE, there's a significant number as well, China, Ghana, et cetera. What we've observed is that while some have been successful, we've also noticed that many simply did not make it, and they had a tendency to close maybe within the first 5 years. In particular, I would think Japan has been a challenging place for a branch campus to succeed. Yet Temple, by any metric that I can come up with, has been a great success story. Why has Temple been so successful with the whole branch campus concept? Tell us a little bit about that.
By way of background here in Japan, in the 1990s, when the Japanese economy was booming, there was a major push from universities in the Western Hemisphere to come into Japan and to open up campuses with the idea of providing a Western education in English to the Japanese. So there were probably about 40 different universities that came in. And to your point, very, very few survivors. Temple was the first to come into Japan. And we, this year, actually celebrating our 40th anniversary, which is quite amazing. And yeah, as you turn and look, there's one other institution that offers 2-year degrees that have been here for about 30 years. But other than that, you really have not seen people succeed in the market. I think a big part of that is governmental regulation. The government, I know, did not welcome Japan, did not welcome Temple University. It took us close to 25 years to gain official legal status that enabled us to sponsor student visas. So for the first 25 years, it really was fighting upstream. And Temple has continued to do that and really kind of blaze a path. But I think the Japanese market is very challenging. You know, costs, language, kind of going back to some of the things you need to adapt to, a different education schedule, a different approach. All of those things have been really high hurdles. Temple has been able to be creative and adapt. We run on a trimester system as opposed to, you know, the standard US system. We're within that, but you know, we've added a full summer semester as part of that. I also think that part of Temple's success has been champions at our main campus. You know, Temple University is a state-related institution in Pennsylvania, and it's very rare for a state institution to be so forward-thinking and proactive on the international scale, particularly here in Japan. But it really, if you think about, you know, the individuals, I think, inside of Temple, they were truly committed. It wasn't about finances per se. They knew that in Japan, it's about relationships, and those relationships do not come easy. You know, they are developed over long periods of time, and I think that's a cultural factor that's there as well. So really, when you think about the perseverance factor, you know, it's part of Temple's mission is to persevere. And when you think about our mission here, it truly is international. So as we bring in students from around the world, 60% of our students are from outside of Japan, 40% from the US, 20% from about 60 different countries, and about 40% from Japan. So I think that formula, bringing in students plus relying on local students, having graduate, undergraduate, non-degree programs, I mean, it really has been this massive recipe where we've continued to put in ingredients over the last 40 years. And through those champions, the perseverance and the right recipe, we've been able to succeed here in Tokyo and Osaka.
Well, let me do a quick follow-up to that. It sounds like perseverance, maybe plain old-fashioned stubbornness, had a lot to do with making this work. I mean, 25 years to make something like this and get the visas and everything else is rather extraordinary. What would be the advice that you would give another institution, whether they're going into Japan or going into another country? What would be your advice to them if they are looking at going into another country and setting up a branch campus?
You know, I think there are so many different things that play into that. You know, one, I think, is partners, making sure that you're in partnership with the embassy, for instance. You know, in our case, the U.S. Embassy, and they've been great supporters, you know, through our 40-year existence. I know there have been several times where I'm sure Temple was thinking, boy, we may just want to pack up our tent and, you know, return back to Pennsylvania. Even at one point, I know that foreign universities and branch campuses, you know, it was one of the major components on the U.S. trade agenda and part of the negotiations with Japan. So I think having those type of partners is critical. Finding folks in that country that you can truly rely and trust, I think that is key as well. You know, there are situations where if you have the rug pulled out from underneath you once you go into a new country, it's very easy to leave. And so finding those champions, the local champions, I think very important. You can find private enterprise, kind of almost develop your public, private, or maybe your town to gown relationships before you enter that country. Right. I think that's something that is key as well. And I think really making sure that the mission is solid and sound. If you're going into a country thinking, okay, this is going to be lucrative, you know, it's something that's going to help sustain us financially, I think it needs to be flipped and you need to re-examine exactly why you are doing this. If it's more educational, if it's more for the long term, your likelihood of succeeding goes up, as opposed to that short-term profit thinking, I'm going to come into a country, establish a university, and people are going to come start throwing tuition dollars at me. You know, that may come as a shock and a surprise when that doesn't happen the way that it was originally envisioned.
Very good. Central?
Yeah, Matt, you led three different universities as a president. And when we talk to many university presidents, they mention this is a very lonely job. As many of our listeners of this podcast are either current presidents or aspirants for such leadership roles, can you please share with them some lessons that you learned and some best practices that you observed in other presidents?
You know, exceptional question. I certainly would not take issue with the statement that being a president can be a lonely job. You know, as you are, you know, trying really to do what is in the best interest of not only the university, but the students. And so I think, you know, my first answer to that question really is, if I'm thinking about best practices, it's really staying close to the students. You know, they are why we do what we do. And, you know, just saying that certainly is not enough. I think you need to show that. I think some of my best moments as a university president really have been engaging with the students. And so, you know, you'll see me at a university once a month here. We do de-stress days for our students, where as they walk in the door, you'll see me handing out Baskin Robbins ice cream or Subway sandwiches. You know, we did chocolate bread on Valentine's Day and really kind of getting to know the students and seeing their smiles, developing that relationship of trust. I think that's something that really plays out well. I've been known to be on basketball intramural teams, playing with our volleyball club late at night, you know, and really having a reason to be here. You know, the students inspire me. And hopefully somewhere along the lines, I can inspire them. I think another technique, and you hear this a lot, but it's true, is hiring people that are better than you. You know, if you can hire folks and plug them in, you know, to key positions, I mean, it makes all the difference in the world. And, you know, as I came here to the Tokyo campus 2 years ago, that was one of the things that I set out to do was, identify the needs and then go out and find folks who have that knowledge, that expertise, and that experience, and then just trusting them to go and to elevate, you know, education to a different level. I also think another thing in terms of best practices is just sticking to your guns. You know, as you analyze situations, you assess, you know, drawing on your own experience and you know, listening, of course, particularly on the front end, you know, not necessarily, you know, changing, you know, left and right. But, you know, once you've made a decision, stick to your guns, make sure that you've got, you know, all of the evidentiary support going forward. And then I think, you know, if you make the wrong decision, you know, being able to change directions, you know, innovation is not perfect. So as you're moving forward and innovating, I think being flexible and adaptable is one of the things as well. And then I think the last thing here that immediately came to mind was, you know, you're always going to have detractors. And so making sure that you actively and genuinely engage, you know, with those detractors, you know, take an interest, figure out why they're being detractors. It may be at the end of the day that you're just agreeing to disagree, but, you know, if those detractors know that you care, if they've seen that you listen, you know, if they're willing to, you know, I think understand where you're coming from, even if they don't agree with it, it can make things a little less lonely, you know, in the president's chair.
Yeah, thanks. Dean?
Many of the people we've talked to a number of foreign-born academics and administrators who have come to the United States and made a career of it. It's relatively rare to find Americans who go over the seas and either end up in Japan or in other countries. You've not only done it once, you've done it twice. I'm very curious about that. I'm curious about what attracted you in that direction. And the second part of that question is going to be, is that when you went back, which was what, 11 years or so later, what did you find different? How was that changing?
You know, exceptional questions. You know, I think one of the things that has attracted me to the Japan campus of Temple University, not once but twice, really is my own experience. You know, growing up initially in the Rocky Mountain region, you know, I never envisioned that I would, you know, do anything international. You know, I came from a household with very humble means. You know, the idea of travel was hopping in the family station wagon and, you know, driving to the next state. And, you know, we were fortunate even if we were able to do that, right? One of our vacations was a 25-minute car ride to a local park in another city where we had a picnic. And that was kind of how I grew up. And interestingly, you know, as I went to the University of Utah for my undergraduate experience, I decided to do some volunteer work for my church. Didn't get to choose where I was going to go, purely volunteer to go and do service and to talk to people about my beliefs. And the church asked me to go to Northern Japan. And boy, that was a shock. In fact, after the church asked me to do that, I was trying to figure out how I could unvolunteer because I was not interested in doing anything international. But believing there was a higher purpose in store, off to Northern Japan I went. Probably the coldest place on the earth, at least it sure felt like it at the time. And, you know, but there was something that just was infectious. You know, the Japanese culture was amazing. The people were incredibly nice. You know, I was truly scared of the food. I love Japanese food. You know, the language was something that, you know, as a 19-year-old, I was able, I think, to overcome and to communicate. And around every corner, there was, you know, a different adventure, something for me to learn. You know, I truly was fascinated with the fact that there was not one right way to do things. There was multiple ways that you could accomplish the same thing, and both of them were right. I mean, it was just truly amazing to me. And so, you know, through this transformative experience with you know, really an international education, just hands-on, you know, it was outside of the classroom, there was something inside of me that just said, you know, if I can assist other students, other individuals to get outside of their comfort zone and to do something on an international scale, I want to be there. I want to be part of it. You know, I want to take my story of really coming from like a humble background and saying, look, you can do it too. And in this globalized world in which we have, I mean, you can play a major component in it. So, you know, interestingly, I started off my college teaching, my university teaching and administrative career here in Japan at Temple University, and didn't think I would really ever come back. But, you know, as you said, I was gone for 11 years and, you know, had the opportunity to come back here as dean and president of the campus. And part of my thinking at the time was, wow, you know, if I can, for another generation, make an impact, get them to come here to Tokyo, experience what Japan has to offer, what you can learn in Asia, you know, be in an environment that I talked about with students from 60 different countries that really is a close-knit environment, almost similar to what you would see at a liberal arts institution on the East Coast of the United States, you know, that would be wonderful. And so that was really what kind of attracted me back. You know, 11 years removed from Japan, you know, it was very interesting coming on back. I think one of the things that I was surprised about was how quickly the world is moving outside of Japan. And when I came back, there was not a lot that had moved. Japan still using facsimile machines. I mean, here, you know, you've got one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world. And when my secretary said I had to put my fax number on my business card, I had not used a fax, I think, since I had left Japan. I mean, it was just amazing. You know, we have these seals that you have that, you know, you put on paper, right? And so instead of a signature, why we do these, I have no idea. The concept, at least at the campus here, about doing an electronic contract was such a foreign concept that, you know, my new mission became, okay, I am going to digitalize, I'm going to shift away from paper. And so as I came in, I told folks, I said, you've got 3 months to figure out how to get rid of paper, because I'm not signing anything physically unless I'm legally required to do so, you know, and that was something that was truly, I think, a shock that was here. Japan's a wonderful place, very, very committed to education. So many great things, but in terms of the world and where it was in, it's kind of a shock coming back in that regard.
That's great. Sental.
Yeah, Matt, I have often heard that behind every man, successful man is a woman. But we also believe that behind every successful leader, not behind, in front of every successful leader, are great mentors, inspiring people, guides, who kind of encourage, pull us along. Can you think of a few people like that in your life who helped you, who encouraged you to be where you are today?
Absolutely. And yeah, to your first point, I mean, all of what I have done is definitely attributed to my lovely wife, Noriko, who is from Japan, but we met in the United States and we've been married for over 30 years. And without her, I certainly wouldn't have been able to do any of this. But when you talk about education, you talk about, you know, administrators, it actually goes back to 1997, where, you know, I was a study abroad student here in Japan, at the Japan campus of Temple University, sitting in a law class one day, learning Japanese law in English, being taught by Vicky Beyer, was her name. And I remember just, you know, listening, watching, and looking at how passionate she was about teaching inside of the classroom, but also outside of the classroom, how committed she was to making a difference in the life of others, really truly a servant leader. Lining them up with internships, listening to, you know, their different struggles, trying to find ways for people to network, and really just almost a wraparound service type mentality. And me sitting there thinking, I want her job. I mean, how great would this be to be able to learn, to teach, you know, to be able to really make an impact in Japan as an American here? And being able to come into contact with many, many people while serving students and just meeting fascinating people. So I actually told her at the end of the program, I said, Professor Beyer, I want your job. And so I said, as soon as you're done with it, let me know, because I'm going to come back. And, you know, lo and behold, 3.5 years, 4 years later, I had her job. And as I was back in Japan doing this, I mean, it truly was, the student's first mentality, trying to serve, trying to go forward. And that was one thing that, I think I learned from her as well. That same time, the dean of Temple University's School of Law, Robert Reinstein, he happened to be a visiting faculty member in 1997. Amazingly, he was able to separate from Philadelphia for a semester and come to Japan with his wife. And I got to know them during that 1997 time and really got to meet with the dean, see his style, learn from him. We had different conversations. And so fast forward, when he was in the process of hiring me 4 years later, we had many opportunities to sit down and talk about, his commitment to international education, talking about perseverance and some of the things that he had done to ensure that Temple University was going to stay in Japan. And then also on a professional level, talking about how to deal with faculty, administrators, students, problems and the like. And one thing that I'll never forget is literally the first day when I came as an administrator and faculty member to Temple University, sitting down and Dr. Reinstein basically said, look, if there's one thing that I want you to remember from today, it's just laugh. There's going to be so many times where you're going to want to bang your head. There's times when you're going to want to scream. There's times when you're going to want to cry. Whenever you feel like that, just laugh, because you're not going to be able to instantaneously change things. And laughing sure makes the heart do much better things than around, what you would see with the other emotions that are out there as well. And that's something that I really have truly carried with me. And that's just one of hundreds of examples that I could share with, Dean Reinstein. But, they truly, both of them were inspirational to me. And Dean Reinstein is someone who I still to this day, continue to consult with, continue to engage with, and, someone who really set me on my path to career in higher education and senior administration.
Wonderful. Dean?
Matt, this will be our last question. We've talked about the institution, we've talked about you, and we've talked about leadership styles, but an institution is not an institution unless it has alumni and graduates. And this has been 40 years since you've started, this campus has been started. I'm very curious, now that you have a bit of a history with this, what's happened to your students once they have left the confines of Temple? Where have they gone? What have they done?
Yeah, it's amazing when you think about the Japan campus here over the course of 40 years. I mean, we literally have graduates that have spread out around the world. The bulk of our graduates stay in Japan, either Japanese citizens who want to be here, or more significantly, the students that we attract from the United States and other countries around the world. They want to be in Japan. Temple University's Japan campus becomes a springboard of sorts. But also what we've seen is as students come in and they get in this international environment, they are able to spread out. So we have, many students that are spread out throughout Asia, some that are in the Middle East. In fact, I've got three of my students who currently are working in Dubai, for instance. Many of our American students will, go back to the United States, distinguished by their experience, much richer for, the international and global environment that they were in, and then taking that cross-border knowledge that they have and apply that to careers, maybe in their hometowns or in different places as well. Europe, South America, Africa, it truly is amazing to see, what our students are able to do, the impact that they have been able to make over the last 40 years in this global world, because of the fact that they had the Japan experience.
Well, let me do a quick follow-up to that. Number one, you're now invited when you do the alumni meeting in Dubai. Let us know. I suspect we can come over and we can pretend that we're Temple graduates. I don't know.
But we'll adopt you, absolutely.
Very good. But the other thing really has to do with traditionally, and this, I come from a fundraising world many a year ago, and I always look at alumni somewhat in a fundraising mode, but I think I found that there's a lot more to it than just raising money, because that's what usually drives alumni crazy, is that all you do is ever ask me for money. How else have alumni helped you in Japan, and how have they helped Temple in the United States? What other things besides their financial support have you seen?
You know, I think one of the things that immediately comes to mind is advocacy. When you talk about the challenges that Temple has encountered here in Japan, their advocacy has been invaluable. As we have interacted with local governmental officials, national, officials that are here, folks that have been able to come through our halls, have done just an amazing, job, I think, stepping up for us as well. I also think from an alumni perspective, just job markets, as you come into a job market, particularly somebody who's coming in as a foreigner into Japan, I mean, that's something that can be tough skating.
Yeah.
But through an alumni, network here, it's very easy, or I guess it's easier for our students to come in and land internships, to have those networking opportunities, to be able to get jobs, mm-hmm. to be able to be plugged in, that are there as well. So, when I think about alumni, fundraising naturally is one approach, but even more so, and more importantly, really on the advocacy side and the inroads, opening doors to employment and really moving forward. Those are things that we've seen here in Japan. We've seen those things, in the United States and other countries as well, as we have looked to recruit students, for instance, right? Who is a better recruiter than somebody who's actually been through that program? And when you've got alumni active throughout the world, they are more than willing to meet students, to engage with local institutions. You have some benefits that I think arise there when you're doing this on a global scale.
Very good. Central, why don't you close it out for us?
Yeah. We like to thank our special guest, Dr. Matt Wilson, CEO and Dean of Temple University Japan Campus. That concludes this episode of Higher Ed Without Borders. If you would like to comment on today's show and suggest a future guest, please go to www.higheredwithoutborders.com comment section. On behalf of Dean Hoke, Ejual Ains, Dr. Wilson, and myself, thank you, and make sure to subscribe via your favorite podcast.
This has been a production of EduAlliance, an international higher education consulting firm with offices in Abu Dhabi and Bloomington, Indiana. Nathan and Hoke, along with their team of experienced professionals, have assisted universities worldwide. To learn more about EduAlliance, go to our website, www.edualliancegroup.com. You will find details on our podcast, contact information, and our services. Thank you.